What we'll do this morning is we'll walk through the economy, talk a little bit about the election, figure out what's really important, and also go through many of the issues with digital media, which I think are pretty fascinating. I'm trying to put it all into the right perspective for you. And then some discussion about how the print business needs to be more flexible but unshakable at the same time. It needs a very good, firm foundation, and I'll describe what some of those foundational things are. So digging into the economy, every month we publish our recovery indicators. For a few months, everything was positive and greater than what it was at the onset of the recession in December 2007. It's hard to believe that we're still talking about the recession and whether or not we're really out of it for almost 5 years now. Technically, we've been recovering since June of 2009, and you only see that really in the GDP data. You don't see it confirmed by a lot of other data. This has brought, you thought conspiracy theorists just came out this past Friday with the unemployment report. We'll talk about that too. But there's been great concern about how the Bureau of Economic Analysis, you didn't know there was one, did you? adjust GDP for inflation because they do it with a different way than the Consumer Price Index. So you see a lot of industrial series that are still trying to get back to their December 2007 level. In this particular one, we look at the NASDAQ because it doesn't have banks. And that's up about 18%, but after you adjust that for inflation, it's only up about 7% since that time. And if you remember back in 2000, what does the NASDAQ have to get to reach that level in today's dollars is somewhere around 6,600. So we're well below 2000. If you just some investment advice here, if you dollar cost averaged all that particular time, you're up a fairly good percentage because you bought lots and lots of shares when the NASDAQ was down around 1,500. Also, the Institute of Supply Management reports did have were better this month than they were the month prior, but the one that I watched very, very carefully is something called proprietor's income, which gives us a window on what's happening in small business. That's up almost 10% since the start of recession, but after you adjust for inflation, it's actually up 0.1%. So it's essentially flat since that particular time. I also look at GDP on a year-over-year basis. All the reports that you get in the news, it's a quarterly change. But you're usually better off because there are so many revisions doing a year-over-year for the same particular quarter. And we see that GDP has not reached the post-World War II level of 3.3 to 3.4% a single time doing this. And also you can see there the depth of the recession. One of the things that we must have in our head is that the economy doesn't matter that much to printing. It's the changes in technology and communications that are far more powerful than anything that happens in the economy. And as some of you have heard me explain for many, many years, GDP growth and the economy are actually inversely related. The stronger the GDP growth, the bigger the decline in print because more and more investment can be made in these communications technologies. So aside from rooting for a depression, which would make it inversely, we'd start printing all over again, I don't think anybody believes that, but that's what the statistical relationship is for this particular period of time. So all data points are for a particular snapshot of time, and that's the relationship that they have now. Now, I thought I'd get a little bit geeky on you, which is why I'm using smaller type, and talk about Friday's unemployment report, which was really quite interesting. I think that the improvement in employment was only overshadowed by the improvement in conspiracy theories about the statistical data. It doesn't mean that the report was right, because none of these government reports are right, because they're always revised. Sometimes we don't get accurate data for 3 years. At that point, it's only good for historians and not good for business people. The unemployment data, though, is the closest data we have to having a real-time assessment of what's happening in the economy. That calculation of the percentage of unemployed comes from something called the Household Survey. You don't read about that in the news. Everybody focuses on the payroll survey for how many jobs were created. But because this dropped from 8.1 to 7.8%, the percentage rate got a lot of reporting, but the payroll data was actually pretty bad. It was only 114,000 jobs. Now, those are people who get W-2s. The household survey includes the self-employed. So all of a sudden, we're supposed to believe that about 660,000 people, self-employed, all of a sudden came into the marketplace last month. And this is a statistical quirk, and this is, tells you why you should not be looking at individual months of data. You should be looking at trends in data long term. These data fly around a lot, and you get a sense from the news reports that these data are certain. They're rock hard. They are not. They're constantly being changed. One thing that the Bureau of Labor Statistics does that a lot of folks don't like is that they don't go back to update the unemployment rate percentage, feeling that it'll be too confusing for the marketplace. So that if they got it wrong and they find out that it was 8.0%, you won't hear that. You can go back and calculate it yourself, but that won't be part of the news. So any time that something is published and it's numbers and it's got a decimal point, it gives a false sense of precision to what's actually happening. So as I looked at the report, the bulk of the job increase was among teenagers, black, and some high school classifications. Three of the highest unemployment rate classifications, we're supposed to believe, occurred last month. That is likely a sign that those data are going to be updated at some time in the future, because those categories typically get better after the economy gets a lot better. And we know the economy didn't get a lot better because we just got the GDP revision where they revised it down twice from 2 to 1.7 down to 1.3. And a lot of the other economic data are not showing that kind of strength. Another key point in this was something called U6. Everyone hears about, oh, the unemployment rate doesn't reflect people who are discouraged or drop out of the workforce and all that. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has data for anything that you can imagine. It's just that the press doesn't always report on them. And that's what this particular category is. So U6 stayed level at 14.7%, which is the real unemployment rate in a lot of labor economists' mind. So that was flat. So the regular unemployment rate got a lot better, but the unemployment rate that includes discouraged workers and the like stayed exactly the same. So this was a very, very strange unemployment report, and the changes in it are not historically consistent with the way the economy shows an economy that's recovering. One of the problems is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics hasn't adjusted their seasonal adjustment factors in a prolonged economic downturn or prolonged economic sluggishness. So every month they're changing their seasonal factors. This is driving a lot of labor economists absolutely crazy, because every month seems like another dartboard that they pulled out to try to figure out what's going on. So the overall number tells you, okay, that's fine, 7.8%, that's what the number is this month. It's still above what full employment would be, which is somewhere between 6 and about 6.5%. Still has a ways to go. You still have about 2 million people who have exited the workforce who need to come back to the workforce. So as you get into the guts of it, it wasn't a very, very strong report. So the headline looked actually pretty good. When you dived in and looked under the hood, there was still a lot of problems with the engine of the car. The expectation that these numbers are going to be actually correct is proven by the number of government revisions that occur over the years. Just last year, like they do every May, they revised printing industry shipments data back 5 years, which didn't help you at the time 5 years ago when you're trying to make a decision about your business. So this is why you always need an ear to the marketplace. You always need some confirmation about what you're actually seeing, why talking to your customers is really important, getting a real sense of what's affecting their businesses as opposed to be relying on economic data, which is usually too broad and too nonspecific to be useful in a lot of your own individual planning. Okay, so I got through the two geeky slides. Let's talk about some other things that are happening. Real per capita disposable income, that is the income per allocated for the population after adjustment for inflation has not recovered. In fact, it was higher at the beginning of the recession, and in fact, toward the middle of the recession than it is today. This has been a serious problem in terms of consumer spending and investment for all kinds of industries. Mortgage delinquency is still bad. It's still running between 10 and 11%. It has not gotten much better. This is an area where the Fed is very concerned about the value of homes decreasing so that even more mortgages are underwater. And that's one of our problems. The Fed is acting on goods that have already been produced as opposed to the encouragement of the production of new goods and services, which would raise incomes and therefore start to solve this. So they're really worried about the banks falling apart again. I believe that when they announced QE3, they looked at a lot of economic measures and they started to panic, but in the very dignified way that the Fed is supposed to do that. Another concern is the condition of small business. I've drawn two red lines here on the National Federation of Independent Business Business Optimism Index. One is from the low point of the early 90s recession and then the low point of the early 2000s recession. And you see this index has been basically bouncing off those particular areas. At one, in the depth of the recession, it got a lot worse. But it hasn't recovered to the point of anything that shows economic growth. Now, some people would think that this is bad for printing. It probably is. But it's not necessarily bad for media because they keep reallocating their budgets or looking for ways that are low cost to communicate with their audience, and that's part of the attraction of digital media and social media and the like. And we still need to be able to tap into that. And everybody knows that the Federal Reserve has expanded its balance sheet. Most of this money has been sitting in banks, and they put it back on deposit at the Federal Reserve to make an even worse amount of interest than you do when you try to buy a CD. But it's not being released to the marketplace because they still have to make their balance sheets look good. That's a real problem because it means that the Fed, the more and more money they keep pumping out, the less and less effective it's going to be. And in a way, what's really corrupting about this in terms of the economy is that money starts to become separated from the amount of goods and services produced, where money is supposed to be a reflection of the activity of the economy and the transactions that are occurring. But what they're basically doing is if everybody in the hospital has a fever, then they take your reading with their thermometer, and then before they read it, they put it under water until it gets down to 98.6, and then they write 98.6 on the paper. Everything is fine. So that's what they're trying to do. So the price level of money is an extremely important part of the way business people judge what they should do. And they've fixed the pricing to such a level no one can rely on interest rates for an indicator of what's happening. Now, it hasn't always been this particular way. In what I call Greenspan 1 and Greenspan 2, Greenspan 1 before the Y2K increase in the money supply, because they were really worried about that, Alan Greenspan basically was following the actions of the bond market. So the bond market would set a price. He would look at the price. How much did it change? That's how much I'm going to change the money supply. The other thing Greenspan was doing was following the average long-term price of gold. And he was changing the interest rates based on that. We became all detached from that after the Y2K. That bubble burst with the stock market. Then they created another bubble. That housing market bubble burst. And then with the way Ben Bernanke started to lower rates to try to get the economy going, they didn't have enough fear in the marketplace for it because he kept announcing what they were going to do next time. And you want the markets to be very concerned about not having any clue about what the Fed is going to do next. That fear builds in a sense of discipline in the marketplace. I know you don't hear this on TV, right? That fear builds in the discipline in the marketplace, but instead it's given them carte blanche to do almost whatever they want. So the dollar is extremely weak. We're trying to force exports, our exports into the world with a lower dollar. And our goods are cheaper, but the other thing that happens is dollars that are overseas come back and they start not just buying goods and services, those dollars are used to invest in U.S. companies or to buy U.S. companies, which is not necessarily the third or fourth order effect that they were looking for. They just wanted the people to buy goods. So this is still playing out, and it may actually get weaker and weaker. And then when you start to look at some of the history of central bank management, I didn't know that Japan just started QE8. So what are we got another five coming our way? So typically these cycles in U.S. History run about 16 years. We probably have about 10 years to go, and we hope that we don't run into what Japan ran into. One of the issues in Japan, of course, is a negative birth rate, and our birth rate here in the U.S. is still positive birth rate, and also the overall population is still growing. So for those of you concerned about inflation, and every single one of you should have this concern, it's still very important to go back and adjust your company's financial data so that you get a perspective on what's happened with the value of what you did in the past. If you thought business has been flat for the last 5 years, it's actually probably declined. And you also have an additional hurdle to get over to make sure your business is growing. Because this is an interesting thing that happened. I can go back to this slide later if you like. I'll jump ahead here. I'm going to go back. Printing gets cheaper every day because printing prices don't keep up with inflation. But everything else on the income statement does. Right? So prices don't go up, but you have all this increasing cost inside your income statement. You've got to find a way to replace that gap. And that is something that printers face almost every single day. And they do that by trying to add more volume to decrease their unit costs. That can be very effective, but it's got to be done constantly in this kind of environment. So here are the underlying themes of the economy. There's a focus on efficiency. That's why productivity tends to be greater than economic growth. As long as productivity is greater than economic growth, the employment markets will be rather stagnant. You want situations where GDP is growing so fast that productivity can't keep up with it, and that more and more people are hired in that particular situation. That is not the case today. That's why the payroll survey is only showing 100,000 or so increase every month. So the efficiency has an immediate payback, and it's immediately measurable. There's very, very little risk to it other than any financial loans that you may have to take. But you're constantly looking to change your costs in the hope of making up for that gap between print prices that are not keeping up with inflation and all your other costs are. You replace that with some productivity to get a sense of control over it. The way the economies have been playing out and the concern over the fiscal cliff has been basically to discourage expansion risk, so that when people look out and they're doing a net present value, gosh, this sounds like finance class that I think I got a B or something in. When you're doing a net present value, what are some of the things that you're supposed to take into account? The inflation rate. Nobody doing a net present value today is going to believe that they should use a 0.5% or 1% or 2% inflation rate. They know in their heart it's going to change. No one knows when. Could be 10 years from now, 15 years from now. So that means that the net present value calculation is not coming out the way that makes sense or takes into account risk. The other thing that happens is with all this money that's been printed, people have to start using a higher inflation rate in their calculation too. Even though the inflation rate seems particularly low, there's always concern about that it will go up to 3 or 4, 5 or 6% at some point, similar to what we did in the 1970s. So when you run a net present value and look at a project that's going to be out 10 years, won't be generating cash flow for 2 or 3 years, the bar that project has to get over to be worthwhile investing in is incredibly high. So this discourages long-term investment. When you add to that the potential tax rates, basically you're discouraging the formation of new wealth. Old wealth is very easy to avoid using it or deploy in expansionary ways because you can always hide it. Attorneys, whatever, investments overseas, any kind of thing. You want to protect it from inflation. There are places to do that. But the critical thing for more expansion is to create the desire for new wealth. Now, and wealth, of course, is not always money. Wealth, of course, is skill, knowledge, and those kinds of things. So until we get past this problem of focusing on efficiency, which has been very rewarding because we know the productivity rate is higher than GDP, and the productivity thing can go on forever and shifts over to expansion risks, the economy is going to be pretty stagnant for some time. Now, that brings us a little bit to the presidential election. I'm going to look at it in a way that I believe is quite different than you might be expecting me to look at it. The presidential election is a really interesting thing because you get a snapshot of media every 4 years. And you can look at the change in what's occurred and how campaigns are run to get a better perspective of the magnitude of those changes. In the mid-90s, websites were all the rage. They started to take contributions on the web. That was a really big thing. We learned all kinds of things about internet behavior and the like. That became more enhanced in 2000. And then in 2004, we got more involved in e-marketing, and also blogs became very important. 2008 was the social media election, and 2012 is the mobile media election. And I invite you to look at the last line where I've got 2012. We've had an 11% increase on the number of internet users. The increase of adults using broadband at home hasn't gone up that much. It's only gone up about 9 percentage points. But because the number of internet users went up, and even that small percentage of broadband went up, all the way at the end, you have an increase in broadband-using adults of about 37 million users in the last 4 years. That's almost as much as the initial year of broadband in 2004 of 42 million users. So we've had far more people come into the marketplace for the use of broadband, and broadband changes everything with communications because it creates more and more of an expectation for instantaneous access to whatever information I want at any time, any place, any device. So here's my concerns about the election. I have three basic scenarios, and this is the way I think they play out. A President Obama re-election by any margin basically continues the policies that have been in place in dealing with the slow economy and international relationships and the like. The bottom one, with a Romney win and a possible win in the Senate, which would be narrow, and an increase in the House majority, that can play out too. The one that concerns me is the one in the middle, where, similar to Bush-Gore, we have a situation where Romney wins a very narrow electoral vote and loses the popular vote because of very big Obama support on the West Coast and in other states. This will place the election back into the courts at some point. And you thought you had uncertainty last time. There's going to be a lot of uncertainty this time. And that's my biggest concern about the election. And I think that this possibility is greater than a lot of the talking heads on TV admit. Because when you look at the electoral map, it is actually pretty close. And just a couple of states could create this situation, and very, very wide popular vote margins in some states could create that situation again. So I'm not assigning any probabilities to this. I was thinking of saying, oh, gee, if I say one-third, 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 you'd think I was lying and taking the easy way out. But there are other possibilities, too. So, but I think that the middle one has a better than one-third chance of actually occurring. Now, to one of our favorite subjects. Let's lighten things up a little bit and talk about printing shipments. the purple line down at the bottom is the way printing shipments have been playing out for this last year and our forecast for the next few months. Shipments, as we know, are down about 2% on a current dollar basis. When you adjust it for inflation, it's closer to 4.5. What's really strange, though, with the purple line is that March was the biggest printing month in this new era of print, and all of a sudden May is the biggest month. I don't believe that, because what happened is every May the Department of Commerce updates its manufacturing series data, and they added They took away about $600 million away from the first quarter of the year when they made this update. And then May's data come out, and it's like they added everything back into May. So now we don't even have a good sense of what the seasonality of the commercial printing business is. But that's why I always look at 12-month moving totals. So I'm looking at an annual number all the time to try to take some of that stuff out. But this will definitely be revised again. There's no reason for May to be a very big printing month. It's never been. March has always been big because that's the culmination of all the new budgets in communications and media that have come up. That will be changed. But if you look back in 2007, we still had a tremendous amount of retail printing occurring for the holiday seasons, Christmas, Thanksgiving, whatever, New Year's. And that started to recede, much like my hairline, in 2008. I want to see if you were awake. And then things kind of bunched together in the other years. And I still see that happening. Retailers have definitely changed their marketing mix. And with the pressure of a recession, that gives them all the more desire to make further changes. So I had this slide up, print's getting cheaper every day. Well, if it's getting cheaper every day because the prices aren't keeping up with inflation, how come sales aren't going up? And then this slide tells you, because the cost of computers goes down about 7.5% per year, and the cost of communications plans goes down about 3.5% per year. So this is one of the reasons why there's a major shift in there. The speed of broadband changes the way people use information. And the Verizon CFO says speed entices more usage. And that's one of the reasons why, even though people are buying bigger plans, the cost per unit of connectivity is going down, and they become more and more reliant on these. And companies like Verizon are counting on that. And then last week, one of the founders of Skype announced something called Freedom Pop, where you can now get access to broadband for free for something like 500 megabytes per month before you start getting into their paid plan. The only thing you have to buy is a USB connector for your computer or a holder for your iPhone. And people are using it to supplement their existing plans if they feel like they're getting too close to their limit on their regular service. They just put their iPhone in this particular holder and it jumps over to this particular service. It's new, it's a little spotty, but this is a long-term trend of connectivity essentially becoming free. So this leads to our commercial printing forecast. As you know, I run models on everything because they're easy and I like to get the most money out of my software purchase as I can. So I have what's called the conservative model, which is basically the way the model behaves. It has nothing to do with its registration for the election. And the aggressive model, which is a model that behaves more significantly to recent trends in data. And you see that the two forecasts are really, really quite different. The aggressive model, avert your eyes because it says the printing market will be $20 billion. By 2018. I don't believe that, so I put my forecast down in the right-hand side. The GDP one is the GDP model relationship with print that doesn't work and hasn't forecast the printing industry. Oh, it's got to be about 15 years now, but I run it because people ask me to. Thank goodness for Excel, huh? And this is the change that we've seen over the years in the per capita consumption of commercial printing. All I've done is commercial printing, inflation adjusted it, divided by population, and this is what you get. And you see the buildup on the far left of per capita printing, and that grew significantly because of cold typesetting and digital prepress made the cost of running jobs a lot lower. And at the time, there was also a revolution in database management, which meant that the direct marketers and catalogers could start doing more and more things with their product. Also, that was the time of 800 numbers. Believe it or not, there was a time when L.L. Bean did not want to have an 800 number for their service because 800 numbers were used for unmentionable phone calls at that time that involved giving them your credit card over the phone. And then we kind of flattened out. That was a period of very good growth for our industry. That was the process color revolution in the mid, you know, getting over $500. And then a gradual decline. And then since social media, we've seen a bigger drop in this. And then I have our year-to-date is $259 per person. And then 2020, one of the models says 190. And I put that one there because I didn't want to put the other ones because you'd start throwing things at me. And this is what's happened to our profits. We're still having problems producing profitability as an industry. Part of it is the contraction in the number of firms. But you'd think that with a lot of weak firms getting out of the marketplace that you would see some of the profit numbers go up as people with losses exit the marketplace. It's gone up a little bit, but it's still under the last low point. So it's still taking some time. There are printers making money. There are some printers making lots of money in this environment. And that's a slide that I'll get up to very shortly. Some of you look at the PIA financial ratios. I mean, the survey is the longest continual longitudinal study in our industry. The response rate for the survey has deteriorated a bit over the years, but these are the numbers. We can take a look at them. The average profitability for all printers is just under 2% over the last 12 years. The profit leaders is 9.2, and then you calculate how the other three quarters live, and that's a loss of 0.6%. This got particularly bad in 2009, and it's one of the concerns of the industry, of course, because we do know some printers who are making 20% bottom lines and all that, and they're cleaning the clocks of their competitors. A lot of the story that you hear about printers doing extremely well, they're trampling the bodies of their dead brethren in the marketplace who have costs that are out of line, and especially financing that's out of line with other printers. Also, many of those printers have changed the kinds of products that they offer and gotten out in front of some of the changes in the business. I also like to put this slide up because there's always somebody in the audience said, well, if we just had fewer printers, like losing half of them hasn't been enough for us to get better. That the capacity utilization will change the nature of our business, but capacity utilization has been dropping for around 30 years or whatever it is. And the capacity utilization, of course, has no weight with me because it ignores product mix, other costs in the organization, you know, how well your business does in terms of managing people and all that. It's not just about keeping your press busy. So you get people saying, oh, keeping the press busy is not the way to measure a business, and then they'll complain about capacity utilization. Okay. Another issue that's starting to grow in importance is our rate of capital investment in printing. It's dropped from about 5% of sales, and recently in 2010 was about 3% of sales. That's a concern. We do need a massive overhaul of our installed base. And one of the problems is that there's a paralysis associated with that with the way the installed base was financed. So then you have printers trying to get up enough money together so that they can pay the bank and then also create enough capital so that they can buy something different, and they get trapped in this particular vicious circle. And one of the ways of breaking that circle has been the use of the tuck-in, which is where a healthier printer buys another printer's book of business. That the printer goes bankrupt or finds some other way to dispose of its equipment. The other printer has more volume in their shop, and they run a slightly healthier business. And the issue with that is the data that we see in aggregate on our industry shows a decline, but it masks the fact that there are healthy printers out there. And I'll show you a slide that tells you about something that you many of you know and love, why that happens. Another thing I run models on is our industry demographics. And if I look at what I estimate the 2012 demographics are and what they're going to be in 2020, you see a decline, still about 1,000 establishments per year, which has been going on since around 1993, but concentrated more in the larger print businesses. And in fact, print business is between, let's say, call it about 1.25 million to 1.5 million and higher. The number of those establishments declined about 40%, and an emphasis on smaller printers and the kinds of things that they offer. There's a financial crunch that's implied here for vendors in terms of selling their equipment and also the survival of a lot of those smaller printers, many of whom used to have more employees, and they get scrunched down in that particular lower group. So our industry starts to look a little bit different. One of the reasons the large printers disappear is, you know, the magazines, the catalogs, the newspapers, that starts to get extracted out of the product mix, and you see printers do consolidate their plants. So one of the points for today is that mainstream print is so last century, but the specialties, some of which Guy spoke about, wide format, advertising specialties, special niche markets, those start to dominate the business. So we lose the mainstream, we gain all the innovative ways of having print work with other media or just plain old create all kinds of new goods. But for those who were counted on a particular type of sheet-fed business for a number of years and thinking they could just switch it to digital and save their businesses, it's more the overall things that are happening with digital media that are going to affect this. Digital media doesn't change the size of a marketplace, doesn't change the size of the target audience. It reduces the response rate of that audience, and you have to keep attacking them in all kinds of different ways. That's what multi-channel marketing is all about. You have to go where people are at a particular time. You cannot know that beforehand, so you have to go out in the marketplace in all of those places. So the nature of marketing changes because of that. Content is still very much part of our economy. And advertising agency revenues have been going up. Yet publishing revenues down at the bottom have been going down. Agencies have changed the nature of their business. They're focused a lot more on production of digital media, and they're less focused on buying space in magazines and print publications, and buying time or space in television and radio, and using a lot more other media. Because they can't mark that up and make money on that, they get involved more and more in production. A good reason for an agency to be involved in these things is the consistency that occurs in branding and format and message. And that's one important reason for them to be there. It's gotten to the point where if you take the employment in advertising agencies and graphic design and add them together, there are now more people involved in those industries than in the printing industry. That change occurred sometime in early 2011. So the blue line is the total printing and commercial printing industry employment, and the red line, which is a little jagged because of just the nature of the way it flows with the economy, did cross. That's advertising and graphic design. And you can see how agencies have changed their business. This is a little hard to see. Back in 2009, for example, you had 70% of ad agencies involved in web development, and in 2012, 83%. And then if you go down a little bit, you'd see things like strategic counsel. They always advise their clients about what media mix and allocation they should have, but this is now includes other things. That went from 59% in 2009 to 76%. And you see things like blogging and podcasting falling a little bit by the wayside, but mobile marketing increasing from 24 to 34, video production going from 41 to 48, and the category of social digital media planning and buying didn't exist in 2009, and already 60% of advertising agencies are involved in that business. It almost seems like this is the marketing services business, right? Because you're involved in all those things. The drivers of digital media are not necessarily production costs and things like that. It's the fact that it delivers to target audiences convenience and immediacy. I can get it now, anytime, anyplace, anywhere, anyhow. And trying to provide the infrastructure for that, especially from an imaging standpoint, is something that Richard Romano and I talked about in Disrupting the Future and Renewing the Printing Industry as communications logistics. We still see a tremendous need for that kind of business. Apple, of course, is running this world, it seems, even though there are still more Android phones out there than Apple phones. They are selling iPads at the rate of 2.16 units per second. So by the time it took me to say that, they sold 20 iPads. Isn't that amazing? Tablet ownership is quite interesting, and I made it for the red bars, the first group. One-third of people 65 and older have a tablet of some kind. That's a shocker. $75,000 or more income, 47%. These are the heavy media users. I'm not talking about what they eat or how they take care of themselves. I'm talking about how often they use media. Just wanted to make sure you're still paying attention. And even with that, I couldn't get your attention. And then the last one is college-educated, 41%. So we see the adoption of this, and we can only imagine what's going to be under the Christmas tree this year for a lot of folks. This chart's a little hard to read. It's from Pew Internet. I'll put your attention to the bottom line, which is grayish. How appropriate, because those are people 65 and older. In 2006, people 65 and older were 1% using social networks, and now it's 34%. In 2012. So even those old folks are getting involved in that. There's a group above them, the 50 to 64 group. They become the 65 plus group. I don't know if some of you are worried about that or concerned that you're going to be in the plus group at some point. And all of this has been occurring at a particular time when Wall Street issues all these negative things about Facebook stock and Groupon stock and how awful those things are. It's essential that you separate the stock performance from what's happening in that company. Groupon has 10,000 employees. They've got over $1 billion in cash. Facebook has 4,000 employees. LinkedIn, which is a good one to look at because people pay to be members of LinkedIn at some particular point. When you put a value on that kind of membership, that IPO has almost tripled. So they've only got 2,800 employees. I would like them a lot better than Facebook. So here's the paradox. Printers have to use these kinds of communications in order to sell print. These companies are having trouble monetizing their dreams of what their IPO and what their volumes are going to be. But we don't care about that. If they don't know how to make money running Facebook, that's not our problem. Facebook is there for everybody to use. And also, we don't need to sell new media services. We just have to compete against them or put things in the right context for them. So how do we have this tension between something that's flexible and something that's unshakable, something that's a foundation for a real business? It all starts with the owner and whatever culture the owner sets the tone for in their business. The way we express a culture practically is often in the kinds of equipment that we put in our shop and the way we lay out the shop. That's an expression of the kind of culture that we want to have in our business. Very few people think of it that way. And the judgments that we make and how we get them wrong, plus side or negative side, the question is, how does the business adapt? If it misjudges that demand is actually going to be higher, how do they adapt to that? Or if it's negative, what do? They hold on to old stuff that they had, or they reconfigure their business. So the inhibitors to flexibility, one of my biggest concerns is the lack of youth in printing organizations, because you still have people in some printing companies printing out their emails. We should worry about that. All right. There are still some who think that Facebook is something you see at the police station and it's got mugshots in it. Right? Oh, you like these, huh? Broadband is the Bangles. Some of you aren't old enough for that. You don't remember the Bangles. All right. Phil Spitalny's Old Girl Orchestra. Some of you are from the 40s. Okay. You didn't like that joke either. Okay. Sorry. And also the way the financial structure does not match what the business needs to do. So they've made a long-term bet on some piece of heavy iron, The market changes. They try to force feed that equipment with stuff that's inappropriate for it, and that's how profits start to disappear. Also, employment selection is absolutely critical in this, because you need folks who are suited for the marketplace. And there's a misattribution that technology is their strategy for the business. What they buy is the way that they're going to attack a business, and they've got to do it from a much, much different angle. And then you've heard me say many times, you have to know why people print in order to be successful in printing, and a lack of understanding of that customer motivation, and a part of this is tied with the lack of youth in many printing companies, that distorts the way printers interact with the marketplace. And then when things get really bad, they start focusing on transactions. What's cash flow this week? Did we get this particular order? And all those kinds of things, when you do need to have a much broader perspective on things. If you're hands-on in the shop all the time, a marketplace is occurring out there without your knowledge. Where you want to be is hands-on in both places. So the foundation is to understand the proper role of debt, not too much, as little as possible. And make sure the debt, of course, matches the life that you're expecting for whatever capital investment you're making. If something's going to last 5 years, you don't want to take a 10-year lease on it. You want to have it to match the marketing life of the project, not the physical, mechanical life of it. You also want to have a series of scenarios that you've worked out that correspond with unlikely market conditions. Like, what if we have a deep recession? That will never happen. And that's how companies got into trouble, because they didn't adjust for that possibility. They were overfinanced. They borrowed way too much money. Some owners with first and second mortgages on their homes, because small businesses have trouble getting capital from banks, and sure enough, it hits them right across the head. No matter what kind of quality was coming out of the shop, no matter what kind of customers they had, whatever, that killed them. So we need a diversity of thought in companies. Part of that comes from the youth in there who understand media and their place in it. That technology is just a tool. It's not an expression of your strategy. And you've got to be hands-on in all places. As many employees as possible should have some kind of interaction with the marketplace, especially the production people. The owners, some of the owners carry their own books of business. That's important, but they should be involved in not just carrying the really lucrative customers. They should be out there doing their best on the business development side to understand where the business is headed and the kinds of things that they need done. So the answers to all these things is that not all printers should be marketing services providers. I've written a lot about that, but they have to understand the context of media. There are hundreds of ways to run profitable printing businesses, and looking at things like industry standards and industry traditions only makes things worse. You want to make sure that you create your own standards for work in the marketplace. That niche strategies are really critical at this particular time. But remember what happened to the printers who had niches like magazines, catalogs, inserts, newsletters, all those kinds of things. Niches are temporary. One of your jobs as a manager, as a strategic planner, is to always be examining new niches, because that's going to change. And to untie the niche from the equipment. It used to be a situation where if I'm in this particular kind of business, this is the kind of equipment that I have. With everything digital, it's applications that are more important, not necessarily the equipment. And then the real value of the business is how it behaves during adversity. So what that means is business owners who never let their businesses get into trouble are the ones who are the good managers. When everything's going up, everybody seems like a genius. But when things are going down, when demand is changing, when the nature of demand is changing, that's why you find out whether you're really a genius or not. So those are the kinds of things that that really, really matter. So in the end, the survivors of all of this this change that's going on, I believe that printers are going to be healthier, they're going to be smaller as they go through this purging process. They're going to be more sensitized to media. They may not be doing the media integration, but they're going to be far more sensitive to that and be part of it in the way they work with others. They're going to be much more focused on specialties, because the mainstream starts to disappear. and that they're going to be geographically dispersed. The nature of, oh, this town has five printers or whatever, that's all gone. They're geographically dispersed, linking to their customers across broad expanses of geography. We know printers who are already doing that today. But this creates certain sales challenges and certain customer relationships challenges. But the reason for the broad dispersion is that everybody's involved in the specialties. So you're going to be able to find niches in bigger regions and bigger market areas, sometimes national, sometimes regional, sometimes worldwide. So that is the end of my long diatribe here this morning. I want to thank you very, very much for attending, and we can get into some questions. Sure, go ahead. What's your one?
You're able to measure the market leaders, but the one thing you can break out was what percentage of investment and market leaders versus others.
Ah. Oh, that's a good question. That wasn't what was on there. On the capital expenditures chart, is that what you're talking about? That wasn't a market leaders thing. That was just the percentage of sales that the industry spends. The other column was what percentage of capital investment was used equipment. Used equipment always expands greatly during periods of recession because banks have to take stuff back. It goes out into the marketplace, finds a new home. But what you're getting at is are the capital investment patterns of profitable printers different than the unprofitable ones? The answer is yes. Profitable printers have less equipment. And that's what's strange about the whole thing. Because they buy what they need, they're not afraid to exceed the capabilities of their equipment. They'll go outside, they'll put on another shift, rather than buying another piece of equipment. And this is a pattern of profitable printing businesses that I think is really, really important to realize, that they have fewer employees for every dollar of sales, fewer amounts of equipment. And when you have less equipment, the equipment burns up sooner, and you're able to replace it sooner with newer stuff that's more productive. I'll try this on you again. Equipment that's used less often lasts longer. Okay? That worked. It was better than the Bengals joke. but that's what happens. You end up with this Noah's Ark of equipment that's not being used, lasts forever, whereas you want to wear the stuff out, especially today. The market appropriateness of equipment is much shorter today, and it's going to get shorter and shorter and shorter. You're better off wearing it out 2, 3, 4 years. This is one of my concerns with folks who are making wide format investments. Wear the stuff out. It's computer equipment. It's going to change. You had another question? You had a question here? You're not allowed to ask it. Yes, go ahead.
The quarter of the companies that are the most profitable.
Yes.
Are they the same year over year, or do you see a difference in them?
Okay, only Printing Industries of America can answer that with their data, but I'll tell you what, from my discussions over the years about that, the answer is yes. There's generally a pattern where about three-quarters of the one quarter are always repeating year after year after year. And it's because that there's a philosophy to running those businesses, not luck. So there's something in there that makes them have less equipment, have fewer employees, emphasize productivity and the like. Go ahead, Gary, do you want to?
Yeah, just to comment on the capital expenditure thing. Don't you think, though, that part of the reason the CapEx is going down is because mix is changing? And Runlink, for example, Runlinks are going down, requiring less costly equipment. Many of these printers are getting into multi-channel communications, mm-hmm. which is not very capital intensive.
Right.
And it's higher profit margins, so you're seeing a natural evolution to lower investment in the industry because of the changes, the fundamental changes in the industry.
That's exactly right. Also, at the beginning of this chart, we were still buying prepress equipment. So prepress starts to disappear. Prepress left this business a lot sooner than I wanted because I'm an old film guy. But it left the industry sooner than I thought. Got involved in direct-to-plate, and even that's slowed down a bit. Obviously, we're making plates direct-to-plate, but when you're decreasing the number of printers who can buy that, especially the ones who need it, who are larger, a lot of equipment gets shuffled around a bit. So, yes, part of the reason is consolidation. Also, as we become more and more a software-based industry, that doesn't have the capital intensity of the investment. Yes, sir.
I was wondering if you'd comment on that. We saw Pat Kennedy, where he says, going on about 8-10 years, 70 or 80% of the revenues in the industry will be controlled by a small group of companies, maybe 1,500, 2,000 companies. Now the 15,000 is closer to
Okay, the question was whether or not the revenues of the industry are going to be controlled by how many?
Oh, 1,500.
About 1,500 or so companies. They always have been. And part of it was because of big, burly printing in the magazine catalog and other that. Even though there were, back when we had 35 or close to 40,000 printers, you had about 2,200 web offset printers and gravure printers who controlled about control. No one really controls the market. Who represented somewhere between 35 to 40% of industry revenues. I as far as that going in the other way, it doesn't seem to make sense based on the other data that I presented here. So I don't think it's going to play out that way. But because it was big products, big high volume mass market products, a very small number of companies had a very large percentage of the commercial offset market. Now, of course, they would always go out to the antitrust lawyers and say, oh, we only have 1% because we only represent this. But when you looked at it on a niche basis, they were extremely, extremely important. Just not anymore. Yes, sir.
Joe, are you going to make your data available?
Yes, I'll correct all the data before I make it available. Yes, I will make it available. If any of you want to, I'll get it somehow. If some of you really need it, to say, can you believe what Joe said this morning? I can lend you my USB drive, and you can copy it right here, if you like. Yes, in the back there.
In the past year, have you seen any shifts in the subcategories that either more promising or less promising, as in books versus...
You hear all kinds of incredibly good stuff from the folks in the wide format business. A lot of it is not in the commercial printing business. A lot of it is more related to packaging and on the specialty side. So that's one thing, I guess, I've got to be a little more clear nowadays, since this is becoming such a big part of the business for many printers. I mean, a lot of that used to be in the color processors, you know, the photographic folks. A lot of that business has become that and it's done by somebody else now, by packaging printers, by sign makers and all that. Everybody's in the wide format issue. And some of it, I would suggest a very good portion of it, is it in commercial printing plants. I do not believe, though, that it represents a large portion of the industry revenues at this point. But for some printers, it can represent half or more of what they've done. But it's not on an aggregate basis. Oh, the thing I wanted to say, I dropped a slide to make things shorter. This way I could go less over time than I am. If you look at the NFL, right? You've heard of the NFL? Yeah, with the strange referees for a couple of weeks there just to make it more interesting in Vegas. Every team plays 16 games, right? Excluding the playoffs, right? So, and there's 15 games a week. I'm not counting the weeks off, but it's basically there's 30 teams, so there's 15 games. Multiply 15 by 16, and then add the games up. That's basically what everybody's record is at when they're 500. I think the number's like 214 or something like that. Everybody's 214 to 214 win and loss, whatever the number is. That's what industry or economic data is telling you. I'm telling you, this is the 500 level. Yet we know teams who exceed that greatly. Economic data can't tell you that. It's giving you the summary of all the winners and all the losers. So that any time that you're studying an industry, you want to look at individual companies to see what's happening and not be so preoccupied with industry data. Now, this is funny coming from me because for the last 9 years I'm writing at what they think or about, you know, aggregate industry things. I try to make that admonition often. But every industry that's declined has had big winners in the process. And just because an industry is declining doesn't mean that you can't have successful companies in it. And we know that's absolutely true. But as you add, industry demand goes down, companies can get bigger in that process, secure a little bit more demand in whatever area they're trading. The industry looks unattractive, but the individual companies do. That's one reason why private equity still has some interest in this industry. I mean, back in the late 90s, it was just to make roll-ups and then try to spin them off and make them go public and make lots of money in the market. But if you're interested in really making money by owning individual companies, there are some really interesting businesses there in that process, and they're going to be masked by the industry data. So that's, you got to be a hunter. Any other questions? Well, have a very, very good show. We will post the slides.